You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Abundant thanks to all of you for coming to this event of the Open Society Fellowship Program. It's a special pleasure for us to be able to introduce Richard Horsey, who begins his Open Society Fellowship today, this morning.
In New York.
In New York. He arrived from Oslo. I don't know when you arrived from Oslo, but
weekend,
over the weekend, a long time ago. But still, it's great to have Richard aboard. Richard is the former ILO representative in Rangoon and is an expert, as you all know, in in forced labor in Burma. His work for the Open Society Fellowship Program includes a book, various forms of journalism, and articles both for the for a trade and specialist readership on the implications of the ILO's largely successful intervention in Burma in the interests of reforming Burmese forced labor practices, of which he's about to tell us a great deal more. And without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Richard Horsey.
Thanks very much, and great to be here. I'm going to keep my comments as short as I can so that we can have as much discussion and back and forth, but not too short that I don't give you a good sense of what it is that I'll be doing in this fellowship and some of the questions that I'm grappling with. I've been working on Burma for about 18 years now. For 10 years I was with the ILO, 5 years based in Geneva, and then 5 years based in Rangoon. And the ILO's engagement in Burma was basically around a single issue, which is the issue of forced labor. Forced labor is serious in many countries around the world, but Burma has a special place, let's say, because it's one of very few countries where forced labor is state-imposed. It takes the different forms. It can be the military, requiring villagers to carry equipment for military operations. It can be various other forms of work for the army, agriculture, support services, and so on. And it can also be infrastructure work for local administrations. In most other countries around the world where you have a serious forced labor problem, it's in the private sector. It tends to be bonded labor in South Asia, or it's private enterprise, as you have in Brazil, for example. There's very few contemporary cases of massive state-imposed forced labor. And that makes the situation in Burma particularly concerning for the ILO. And it gives also the ILO a reasonable amount of legal leverage in the sense that Burma is a signatory to the Forced Labor Convention and does have international obligations. Even if it's flouting those, I think the case study of what the ILO has been able to do in Burma can be instructive more broadly when we think of how the international community can engage with isolated authoritarian regimes. And what I hope to draw out in the study is not just give a very detailed presentation in the book of how the ILO managed to make the progress that it did in Burma, but also try to draw out some lessons that other actors in Burma may be able to draw from this, but also extend it to other similar situations around the world and see if there are any comparative lessons that we can draw. So very briefly, what the ILO did was basically starting in 1997 with a commission of inquiry, which spent a little over a year doing a very detailed quasi-judicial investigation of the practice. It wasn't allowed into Burma, and so it spent its time collecting a large amount of documentary evidence and then interviewing some 200 people with direct experience. And this was either refugees or people currently living in Burma who were interviewed in neighboring countries, Bangladesh, India, and Thailand. That commission of inquiry came up with a damning report and made a number of recommendations which are legally binding on the government. The government didn't appreciate the report or the recommendations. It rejected the findings, but it never took the step of challenging legally the recommendations. It has the legal right to do so, but it never did that. And therefore, they stand. There was a period of a couple of years after that report came out where the regime was unwilling to have any kind of interaction with the ILO. But after a couple of years, we managed to get a process of dialogue happening. And starting in 2000, we made a number of visits to the country, I think 10 visits in all over the period 2000 to 2003, meeting with the leadership, meeting with the opposition, including Aung San Suu Kyi, and meeting with other members of civil society and so on, and trying to craft a strategy that would enable progress to be made on the situation. Because our sense was always that while it may require a change in the nature of the regime to finally eradicate this problem, that there was still a lot of room for making incremental and significant improvements within the current setup in the country. And we were working quite closely, let's say, with a few people within the regime who were attempting to adopt a more pragmatic approach to the international community, who were trying to open the country up. And we successfully made the case that that such an opening of the country would be very difficult if it continued to make use of a practice that was abhorrent to the international community. And so through a process of detailed negotiation, which combined some normative pressure and legal steps threatened or actually taken, together with some quite detailed discussions with the various authorities about what they would need to do to demonstrate progress, to demonstrate that there was steps being taken towards addressing the problem, and therefore keep at bay the legal options, which would be the only other recourse that the ILO had. These negotiations led to a change in the law, not fully adequate change in the law, but let's say a sufficient change in the law. That in itself did very little, of course, to change practice on the ground. So our focus then shifted to how we could have that law more effectively implemented. And we managed to convince the regime to allow us to open an office in Rangoon, which we did in 2002. And I was there for 5 years, from 2002 to 2007. The next step was to try to put in place a form of ombudsman mechanism, an independent authority that victims of forced labor could have recourse to, that would have the power to conduct a prima facie evaluation of allegations. And if there was found to be a prima facie case, to forward this to the legal authorities of the country for action, including criminal action. Obviously, we had many concerns about embarking on such a process. Who should be the ombudsperson? Could we be satisfied that any legal guarantees for the protection of victims that would be built into that agreement would be honored? And this was a very difficult judgment to make about whether we felt we had sufficient guarantees to go ahead with this process. But we did manage to get such a process operating. The ombudsperson, and we never actually called it this for reasons of national pride and sensitivity. It was an ombudsman system, but we called it a facilitator system. The person was the ILO representative, so me, who would receive the complaints, conduct the investigation or the assessment, and then forward the cases to the authorities. And over the course of a couple of years, we had it took a couple of years to get such a system in place. There were many setbacks. But when we finally got to a position where we could implement this, over a two-year period, we had something like 100 to 150 allegations brought to us by victims or representatives of victims. These were often collective cases. So one complaint would be about forced labor for a whole village or a whole community. It wasn't only relating to one person. About half of those were found to be sufficiently detailed, credible and possible to investigate, that we forwarded them to the national authorities. And as a result of those, we had 12 or 13 children who had been forcibly conscripted into the armed forces released. And we had 10 government officials who were prosecuted, found guilty of imposing forced labor, and sent to prison. A number of these cases were also covered in the government-run newspapers. So there was some publicity given to some of these prosecutions. And so I think that, firstly, this was an incredibly intrusive system to put in place in a country as isolated and skeptical of the world as Burma. And so I think it's quite striking that we were able to do that. There's very few countries in the world, I think, who would accept that level of international scrutiny in their domestic legal affairs. So that was one quite striking thing. Another quite striking thing was that, and this was the intention at the beginning, that the impact of the process went far beyond the impact of the individual cases that we were able to deal with. I should say that in the other cases, most of the allegations were upheld. In many cases, the government only responded with administrative measures, sacking the person involved or demoting them or giving them a warning. But in almost every case, the forced labor incident stopped. There were some cases of retaliation against victims, but we managed to also solve those cases. So the impact of this mechanism, I think, was far beyond the number of individual cases. It's a very widespread problem. Clearly, it's not a problem that lends itself to a case-by-case solution. It would take forever. You could never catch... You would need a system that was so large that to catch a large proportion of the cases. But what we were trying to achieve was to undermine the climate of impunity that individual government and army officials were feeling. The sense that they felt that if they imposed forced labor, they could get away with it and nothing would happen. And very quickly, I think the news that government officials were being investigated, and in some cases imprisoned, sent a warning through the grapevine of the government networks. And I believe it had a dampening effect, probably a significant dampening effect, on the incidence of forced labor. I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. It's a huge problem. It remains a huge problem today. We've been particularly challenged in having any impact on the activities of the army. Army officers being the most able to operate with impunity. It's a military regime. It looks after its own. And I think army officials feel that they have much more impunity than, say, local government authorities. So we've had much more limited impact when it comes to forced labor by the army, and we've had much more limited impact when it comes to forced labor in very remote, difficult to access areas of conflict, and so on. And that's a big problem, because these are the areas where forced labor takes its most extreme forms. And where it's most prevalent. And so we clearly have a long way to go in addressing this. If I have to think more generally about the lessons that we drew from this that may be applicable elsewhere, and these are the things that the ideas that I'll be trying to test as I do the research for the book, I draw three lessons from this. One is that these kind of regimes are not monolithic. The second is that they are not Machiavellian. They are not as all-powerful as they believe, and not all abuses perpetrated by these regimes are the result of Machiavellian intentions of the top leadership. Many of them emerge from the climate of impunity, from individual corruption, and many, many other things. And the third is that these regimes are not illogical in their actions. And what often appears to us to be very strange or very illogical steps taken by these regimes may make sense from their rather warped perspective and their rather warped set of priorities. And if these three lessons stand, then I think there are three implications. The first is that if regimes aren't monolithic, then it means you need to find individuals within the regimes that you can deal with, understand what their objectives are, and understand how your actions can affect their position within the regime. If the regime is not Machiavellian, then it implies that, for example, for human rights abuses conducted by these regimes, we need to have a very sharp and accurate diagnosis of the reason why these abuses are coming. If we believe they're not all the evil machinations of the single dictator at the top, but are emerging from systemic problems in some cases, then a different solution may suggest itself, or a different remedy. So accurate diagnosis for the particular problem that we're dealing with, I think, is very critical. And the third, if these regimes are not illogical in their actions, but just have a warped set of priorities, then it means we need to be strategic in how we approach them, and we have to carefully define a political calculus that will have an impact on them. And I think particularly this implies, as do the other two points, that we need to combine engagement with pressure in the right way to achieve the outcomes that we want to see. The need to combine pressure and engagement was very clear from the ILO experience. We did manage to have or create or manufacture some pressure, real or imagined. But pressure alone wouldn't have got us very far, I think, because the regime was clearly not capable of thinking through what interim steps it could take which would be acceptable to the international community as signs that they were starting to deal with the problem. So we had to, in a sense, both apply the pressure but also elaborate for them the alternative path that they needed to take to avoid the pressure. They weren't in a position to do that for themselves. If we just focused on the engagement without the pressure, there'd have been no incentive for them to do what we were asking. And so it was the combination of the two which turned out to be what pushed things forward. This is, of course, the mythical carrot and stick approach in international relations. But I say it's mythical because it's very rare in any international situation that the people wielding the carrots and the people wielding the sticks are actually coordinated and have the same aim in mind. The international community just isn't that coordinated. And so it tends to be one group of people with the carrots and one group of people with the sticks who don't have the same objectives and don't communicate. And so that doesn't lead us anywhere. We need to find ways that the stick holders and the carrot holders are somehow coordinated and strategic. And that's very, very difficult. So maybe I'll stop there. I've thrown quite a lot of stuff out and open it up for questions. And you can ask me to elaborate on anything or...
I might start with a question since I'm holding the microphone. Question one is, were there particular communities and individuals who were vulnerable to conscription in the forced labor apparatus? And second, what kinds of projects were they conscripted to labor on? I mean, were these generally in the interests of regional governments, local governments, or individual members of the military or the governing elite?
Well, it's very clear that the impact of forced labor demands fell disproportionately on the poorest. And there's a number of reasons for that. I said before that the different abuses can arise at different levels within the system, and I think forced labor is a perfect example of that. Some forms of forced labor are the result of direct orders coming from quite high up in the system. For example, orders to use prisoners as porters to carry equipment for the army during operations. This is a system which has been established. It's a policy. It comes from quite high up. It's deliberate. Forced labor in agriculture for army bases arises from another order which doesn't particularly demand forced labor but results in it. And that's an order which tells battalions and regional commands that they have to live off the land. The central army administration will not provide food, will not provide money for their general operations. It'll only provide military hardware and salaries and uniforms and so on. And that means that to feed themselves and to have money to conduct their affairs and so on, they need to raise revenue. And one of the ways that they raise revenue is by using forced labor, either because they force people to work on army-owned agricultural projects or other industrial projects, or because when they need to build a road, rather than paying people, they save the money and force them to do it. So that's a kind of indirect effect, let's say. But then there's a whole heap of corruption down at the local level. Once people feel they have the authority to order civilians around, they do so. And in many cases, they do it to line their own pockets rather than for the interests of the army's operations and so on. So it's very typical that a local army officer or a member of the local government would request 30 laborers when he needs 15 and offer that people can buy their way out. And the money goes in his pocket. And this explains how the burden falls on the poorest, because it's the people who can't buy their way out who tend to have to do the work. The situation changed over time. It seems fairly clear that there was a deliberate government policy for using forced labor on big national infrastructure projects in the 1990s. By 2000, the government announced to us that it had rescinded that policy. And although we were quite skeptical at the time, forced labor did stop on big national infrastructure projects. They started hiring private companies to do it. This wasn't the end of forced labor by any means, but it was the end of the conscription of hundreds of thousands of people on a single big road project or other big infrastructure project. What tended to happen after this was that forced labor was used at local village level for small-scale infrastructure for the village or possibly the township, which is the next administrative level up. The army use of forced labor has changed much less over time. It still continues pretty much to use local people for the tasks that it needs to perform. The big change being that we pushed very hard that villagers being conscripted to work for the army during military operations was the most abusive, extreme, and feared form of forced labor, and the most unacceptable. Unfortunately, the alternative that the regime came up with was to establish a system of using criminal prisoners from prisons to do the same thing. This may or may not have avoided their legal responsibility under the Forced Labor Convention of the ILO, but it, of course, immediately engaged their responsibility under other international instruments. And we were always very clear that this was a completely unacceptable alternative. So, yes, there have been changes, not always for the better.
I'm Anthony Richter, and pleased to meet you. And, of course, we're working on another country. We're interested in another country in which there are very credible allegations of state-directed forced labor, in this case child labor, in Uzbekistan, where systematically hundreds of thousands of young people down to the age of 7 or 8 are forced to about twice a year be involved with the cotton industry. It's always fun to talk about the sticks, but I'm interested also in the psychology of the carrots, because as you suggest, they work together. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. There are growing, in the case of Uzbekistan, there's a kind of growing international activism by retailers like Walmart and Tesco and brands like so many of them that don't want to be associated with this product and the things that have cotton in them from Uzbekistan. And you can also, I'll just leave it at that, talk a little bit about the incentives. The other question is about, you talked about how effective this was, but I also want to talk about the limits of it and why apparently there were some positive spillovers, but not a lot, because while it may have been an effective instrument in dealing with forced labor to a certain extent, it's not been, say, it hasn't encouraged enough observance of the rule of law in the country to foster kind of more wide-ranging change. And talk a little bit about what you see as the limits of this being successful as it has been.
Yeah. The psychology of the carrots. I guess there's two kinds of carrots. There's the carrot which is merely the lack of the stick. And in many cases, we were resorting to the carrot just being we're not going to use the stick. You can avoid this. Yeah, the stick is make-believe and the carrot is imaginary. But, you know, so in many cases, what we were saying is, look, if you don't show some signs of progress that we can demonstrate to our governing board, they're gonna use the stick. You know, you're going to face this International Court of Justice thing. And, you know, that's not in anyone's interest. So let's see if we can work something out here to avoid that. So it was the avoidance of the stick. The other difficulty with carrots is we really need to get into, as I said earlier, one of the lessons from this, understanding regime logic. Because what to us may be a carrot may not be a carrot to them. And very many of the kinds of carrots that have been thought about are the kinds of things that they would actually find quite worrisome, things which may tend to open the society or the country. Western business becoming more engaged. Maybe they see some financial benefits to that, but they also see many concerns about what that will bring with it. So one has to be very careful to craft the carrot which will be in their interest. Humanitarian assistance has been, or development assistance has been thought of as a carrot in some cases, and in the history of Burma has been used or attempted to be used as a carrot many years ago. But they're not really interested in that either. They don't really care about humanitarian assistance. They don't care that much about development assistance. That's a very important aspect of this. In terms of the limits, of course, there was much more to the ILO process than just this ombuds system. The ombuds system was targeted to addressing the impunity and enforcing some rule in a context where there is no rule of law, where there is rule of law, but it's very much eroded, very weak and certainly a very politicized rule of law. It wasn't directly going to bolster rule of law in the country. It was rather creating something which was almost parallel, which would give legal avenues where they would normally not exist. Some of the complainants, some of the victims, were able to use the domestic legal system from the beginning. So we have had cases where, rather than have us funnel a complaint to the national authorities and have them investigate, there's been a direct criminal complaint lodged by the victims. And in a couple of cases, those were successful. The very well-known human rights defender, Su Su Nui, one of the reasons she's well-known was that she was in prison, and one of the reasons she was in prison was that she had successfully sued her local authorities for using forced labor. She was the first person ever in Burma to sue their local authorities completely through the court system and get a successful case. And the local authorities took revenge on her and manufactured a case and got her imprisoned, and we had to get her out, and we did. She's now back again for a very different reason. So we're very far from achieving any systemic change in the legal system or the structures of governance. And, you know, the biggest problem of Burma, I believe, is just the relationship between the governors and the people. It's a predatory, abusive relationship. It's not a relationship of governance. And that's the source of many, many of the human rights but other governance problems that we face in Burma.
Hello, yes. Richard, I'm very glad to meet you again. And I really appreciate the work you have done when you were in Rangoon as the liaison officer. But of course, first I have to introduce myself. I'm Thong Thon, director of the Burma Fund. The Burma Fund is the part of the Burmese democracy movement, and we have been doing human rights advocacy through all available international mechanisms, including ILO, for almost 20 years now. We have been monitoring the forced labor situation and also doing some empowerment program for the civil society, which has been collaborating with ILO. So I want to ask some challenges we see and our efforts to end the practice of forced labor. The first thing is that that forced labor still being committed by the army. That is the major concern, because we have seen improvement in the area of using forced labor and infrastructure development and, you know, in the cities and like that. But forced labor is still going on in the conflict area and mostly used by the army. So there has been a discussion to have a particular interlocutor at the level of Ministry of Defense or at the level of regional commander, so that ILO liaison officer can have direct dialogue with the military. Because I understand that the current format of having dialogue through the Ministry of Labor, I don't think will not resolve the problem of forced labor being committed by the army. So I want to know, what is the situation now? Do the ILO has particular interlocutor at the Ministry of Defense? Second is, as far as I know, ILO liaison office have only two expatriate staffs, liaison officer and assistant, a few local Burmese staffs. Mm-hmm. The office is just in Rangoon. Mm-hmm. So if we compare with the problem, you know, the capacity of the office is very limited. Mm-hmm. So I understand about the discussion to expand the first location of the office, branch office, second stops. What is the situation now? And that is the protection mandate, protection to complainants or civil society groups working with the ILO, because as far as I know, there are at least six people in prison arrested by the Burmese military, including one lawyer, for cooperating with the ILO and being involved in the cases ILO has been working. Of course, and then public awareness mechanism, you know, because the awareness among the public is, I see, very limited. Civil society, of course, we have been trying to empower, but still very small. So how we can do it?
Well, thanks for those very pertinent questions. So first, about the challenges relating to the army. I agree, the army is the main problem and the main difficulty in overcoming the worst abuses that persist. I think, again, we need to break it down into individual abuses and systemic abuses, because the remedy may be different for the two. In terms of individual abuses by army officers, the question will be to try to extend the mechanism to apply also to army officers, to try to get a conviction of an army officer for using forced labor and imprisonment. And that will help to extend this sense of undermining impunity also from the civilian officials also to the military officials. But we also need to address some of the systemic problems within the army. That is the fact that it relies on non-military human labor to conduct its military operations. That's not sustainable. The fact that it's using prisoners from the prisons, which is completely abhorrent. And these people are treated in general worse than the villagers were when it was villagers who were being conscripted. So they are huge challenges, and one of them is a policy challenge, and the other is a question of trying to extend this mechanism, and we've been pushing in both directions. Since I left, the first actions taken against army officers have been taken. So there have been recorded, documented demotions, transfers, and other non-criminal actions taken against army officers. But we're still waiting for the first criminal prosecution, and we're pushing for it hard, and we haven't achieved it. This goes to the very core of what the regime is concerned about. It's a military regime, and putting their own soldiers in court for doing what they had been told to do is a huge step, and this is one that they are very reluctant to take, and it's also one that they must take, and we need that to take in order to consolidate the progress that we've made. In terms of having an interlocutor in the army, it's something that I pushed for very hard when the Minister of Labour was extremely weak and clearly had zero authority over the army. The current Minister for Labour comes from the army. He's still well respected in the army. And I think it's through his interventions that some of these actions have been taken against army officers. So I think it's slightly less urgent than it was in the past. Also, the ILO does now have regular communications with the military. I had written communications with the Inspector General, never face-to-face meetings. Since then, the ILO has been allowed to meet on and off with the committee for the recruitment to eliminate the recruitment of child soldiers, which includes a number of officials who also have authority over forced labor matters. So that gives a kind of structural possibility for communication and discussion. In terms of the capacity of the office, yes, this is a limited mechanism with limited capacity. But I'm not sure that extending the capacity is the best way to extend the impact. I would much rather push for the prosecution of one army officer than to have a second office which can take another 100 cases if the result of those cases is going to be the same. And it's pretty clear that they don't want another office and that we will have to push extremely hard in order to get it. So it's a question of where should we best use our pressure. Is it to get another office which will generate another set of complaints, but no, not necessarily a different outcome, or is it to push for other steps that the ILO needs that need to be taken? In terms of protecting victims, two things. So far, people have faced problems who have helped victims to complain, or victims themselves have faced problems. Very many cases, these were retaliation at the local level by the person they complained against, rather than the retaliation of the system at the top level. And we've normally been able to solve them. Very recently, one person whose case was clearly linked to the ILO, who was arrested, has been released also. But it also gets extremely complicated, because many of the people, the human rights defenders and others who are acting as facilitators and linking the victims with the mechanism, are engaged in other political activities. They're members of the political opposition, or they're human rights defenders in other areas. They're engaged in other things. And clearly the ILO can't convey any sort of immunity on people. So we're limited to intervening when there's some indication that that the reason that they were arrested was because of us. Now, in a number of cases, because we've been successful in getting a number of people out of prison, in some cases, people who want to associate themselves with the ILO in order to have some protection and some chance of having the ILO help them if they get arrested will come and lodge a complaint. So in some cases, people who have the feeling they're about to be arrested will come to the ILO and then say, okay, look, you have to do something to get me out. This is very difficult often to unpick. You know, what is something that we can say is clearly linked to us, and what is more broad issue? Because if we get into the more broad issue, we will just dilute our capacity to intervene so much that we will have no impact. We can't get everyone out of prison in this country. You know, hundreds of people are being arrested for all kinds of things that they should never be arrested for. But the government will never accept that the ILO pushes to get these people out. So this is really the challenge, and it's incredibly difficult to unpick when it is because of an ILO action and when it isn't. And I believe that there are some issues where this is questionable and where we are saying we would prefer to err on the side of caution. And if we think there might be a link, we prefer to think there is a link and push for the release. But there's no cases currently of anyone in prison or other action which is clearly linked to their ILO role. But okay, we can maybe disagree or debate the individual cases afterwards.
Hello, my name is Masha Feginova, and along with Anthony, I work on the Uzbekistan project. Your presentation is very, very interesting, and unfortunately, my knowledge of Burma is limited to the headlines. But from this conversation alone, I almost think, like, in terms of forced labor, Burma is not so bad compared to Uzbekistan. And I have two sets, two questions. One about Burma, and one about the decisions that ILO made to engage. I find the way forced labor works in Burma quite puzzling, because I understand the picture that I'm creating in my mind is that the orders for forced labor come from fairly high up, but maybe not from the very, very top. But I imagine goes without saying that those decisions are sanctioned in the least, if not promoted. So stemming from that, it's puzzling to me that A, Burma would even accept the initial report that ILO made, that it didn't reject your findings as whatever, as rumors, as misinterpretation of the situation, or maybe perhaps didn't try to justify that this is what's needed for, you know, our army to do for national security, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's, yes, I find that puzzling. I find it puzzling that given the amount of sanctioning of these practices, that cases about individual abuses could make it to the press. For me, that's, in case of Uzbekistan, is unthinkable. As is people filing individual complaints or group complaints coming home, you know, fairly well, at least with their jobs intact. So maybe if you can comment on that seeming inconsistency, though I take your point and I agree with you that behind these practices there's a fairly solid logic, even if it only makes sense in the eyes of the authorities. And so my second question has to do with the way ILO decided to engage, because I imagine it was a fairly difficult decision to, you know, to make on what level do we engage, how much, et cetera. Because the danger, of course, is, you know, even though you might have weak teeth to begin with, if you publish this report, if you do these kind of investigations, you might have all of your teeth pulled out, you know, that numbing anesthetic. Yes, thank you. So, you know, how did your office kind of weigh that decision? Because following this report, you know, you could have been just kicked out and not being able to do anything at all. And maybe if you can, taking it broader, if you can comment on how that decision might be made in other countries. Thanks.
Thanks, yeah. So the way the system works, in times past, there was clearly a deliberate policy, maybe not an order, but certainly a deliberate policy of using forced labor on large national infrastructure projects. And that changed when the government issued a law outlawing forced labor. So the orders that come from the top are an order saying you shall not use forced labor. And this was distributed all through the system down to the ground level. Unfortunately, along with that order comes a general confetti of orders from higher up to lower down people. And many of these are, you must improve the local infrastructure, you must do this, you must do that, you must build new buildings, you must improve things, we're coming to inspect. And you have no budget. So the guy sitting down there is going to have two contradictory orders. Build up your area, don't use forced labor. Which one is he going to follow? He knows damn sure that if the general comes down and inspects and he hasn't improved the road, he's in for trouble. He sort of feels that if he cuts corners and uses forced labor, he's probably going to be all right. So what we were trying to do was shift the balance and say, no, you're going to be in trouble. Of course, this guy is also not just a local government official trying to do his job well. He's also probably quite corrupt because his salary is so low and he has no possibility to feed his family if he doesn't engage in corruption. And forced labor gives him the possibility to engage in corruption as well and to improve his income. So we're fighting lots of different battles, actually. So what I would say characterizes the situation now is there's no orders from the top to use forced labor, but there are other kinds of orders which inevitably lead to forced labor being used, such as the order to the army that you have to live off the land and be self-sufficient. That implies forced labor or arbitrary taxation or theft or many other things. If you make the forced labor more difficult, then maybe it implies more arbitrary taxation. And there's some evidence that maybe that has happened. So in a sense, they issued this law knowing that, you know, what's a law? Okay. But then we were in the position to say, okay, but now we're going to help you to implement this law. And that was maybe something they weren't terribly keen on, especially at the beginning. But having issued this law, it was very hard for them to say, well, actually, we're not going to prosecute people who complain. But of course, no one complained because no one would dare complain. So then we had to try and get them to set up a system where people actually could complain. So it was a long iterative process of that kind. And what changed, I think, what was quite significant was the cultural shift within the regime. They went in the 90s from seeing forced labor as quite acceptable, as a legitimate development tool. They would explain quite happily to us that, yes, we use forced labor, but you understand we're a poor country with very bad infrastructure. We're isolated from the world. The IFIs won't help us. So we can only rely on the resources of our own people. That's the only way we can develop the country. So they were quite happy about accepting it. They even put all through the state newspapers, you know, pictures of all these hundreds of thousands of people and numbers, very accurate numbers about how many were donating their labor. So they weren't so embarrassed about it. They actually thought that this was something appropriate. But after a lot of discussion and a lot of pointing out that if you're trying to build a modern developed nation, which is what they were saying, using an archaic abusive practice is really no way to get you there. And actually, this is something which, you know, for a very long time now, the international community has found abhorrent and is not something that's acceptable these days. And that started to filter through. And so then the regime's approach shifted to denial. From excusing why they should do it, you know, it's a cultural thing, it's all we can do, they started denying. They said, okay, we've stopped it and there is no more. And that's actually quite an instructive shift, because as soon as they're denying it, they're trying to cover it up and hide it. And as soon as they're trying to hide it, they don't want it too obvious. And as soon as they don't want it too obvious, it becomes clear to everyone involved in the system that they're doing something they really shouldn't be doing. And that's a positive change. And I think it has impacted on the culture. There's no more a sense that forced labor is what you should be doing, it's what you should be hiding. How to engage? Yeah, this was a very difficult challenge. They didn't exactly accept the report. They said the report was completely biased and unacceptable, but that they weren't going to challenge the recommendations in the International Court of Justice. According to the legal setup, once you have a commission of inquiry, its report is binding unless the government in question challenges it in the ICJ. Otherwise, it becomes legally binding under international law. And they said, we don't accept this at all. We think it's a complete fabrication, but we're not going to actually challenge it. Clearly, they didn't want a high-profile case in the ICJ. They may not even have realized that they had that option, possibly. So then they were sort of in the position where actually they were stuck with the recommendations being legally binding and there was no way out of them. Of course, it was a big risk for the ILO, thinking about applying for the first time remedial measures that had never been tested before. They'd been a useful sort of Damocles, in a sense, in the past, because no one quite knew how sharp or heavy these measures were going to be. But, of course, exactly as you say, having our bluff called and actually having to implement them could be very risky for the ILO, because it could show that actually there's nothing much we can do. I think we managed to avoid our teeth being pulled. So we did apply the measures. They didn't have huge effect, but they were sufficiently toothy to leave the ILO not in too embarrassing a situation more generally. But part of the reason why the ILO has put so many resources, so much thinking, and so much focus on the Burma case is that it is the one which has moved through the supervisory machinery the furthest in the ILO's history. And so there's a sense that if the ILO fails here, if the ILO can't show that in the worst cases of state-imposed forced labor of a country that's ratified the convention, where does this leave the ILO? And so we really need to show that we can do something with it.
I'm Elaine Pearson. I'm from Human Rights Watch. I wanted to ask, we had a report on abuses in Chin State released earlier this year, which included reporting on forced labor. Did you have the ability to conduct investigations in Chin State? Did you receive complaints from them? I'd be kind of interested on that. Secondly, with regard to the cyclone, also some organisations have alleged that there have been forced labour in the aftermath of the cyclone. Do you have any indication whether there's been reports received from the ILO and what's the substance, I guess, of these allegations? And then thirdly, I wanted to ask a bit about, I guess in terms of other UN mechanisms that have not been so successful, I'm thinking here perhaps like the UN Special Envoy, Gambari, because the bar is so low when dealing with Burma, I guess access is often seen and dialogue is just seen as a success in itself. So what kind of recommendations, I guess, would you have for some of these other mechanisms?
Thanks. Chin State, yes, I was able to visit Chin State. I was able to conduct assessments there. In fact, one of the things that we negotiated right at the beginning was that as ILO representative, I would have freedom of access. I could travel anywhere in the country anytime I wanted, giving a few days advance notice about the general area I was going to, but not having to be accompanied and not having a detailed itinerary, subject only to security, valid security concerns. And we had a mechanism in place also to adjudicate what was a valid security concern and what wasn't, so that that couldn't be used just to veto any trip at all. And that was through the ICRC, former ICRC representative, who was felt by both parties at the time to be someone who had a sense of the security situation and was sufficiently impartial. We never needed to resort to that. I never asked to go to the most insecure places, both because it would have been very difficult to operate there. There would have been legitimate security concerns, and I didn't want to trigger a refusal by the government, which may have been a valid refusal, because they do have a responsibility. As an international official, they do have responsibility for my safety. But I went to some pretty sensitive areas where they're pretty close to conflict and in areas which were generally not accessible to anyone. And I never got refused. I had problems many times. I was followed many times, but I never had to completely cancel the trip. So I was able to visit every state and division, including Chin State. Spent a week in Chin State. The travel wasn't always to assess complaints. This could often be done directly with the person when they visited. It was more to get a general sense of the situation in the area, to talk to everyone, to find out, is it improving, is it not, what seem to be the challenges. Meet with the local authorities and also let them know that I'm around and asking these kind of questions. It's a very remote place, very far from anywhere. So there's a lot of problems there. In forced labor terms, certainly not the worst place in the country, I think. It has many, many difficulties. The Delta, as far as I know, there are no credible indications that there's been any significant use of forced labor in the Delta after the cyclone. I'd be surprised if there were no cases. There's cases everywhere. There's certainly, and you'd have to talk to the ILO representative now about what's the situation with complaints and so on. I wouldn't want to speak for him. But certainly my impression is that there is no significant forced labor problem, other than the background level of stuff, which was there anyway.
Yeah. Well,
And the Gambari thing. I mean, partly this is a calculus for the international community as a whole when we're engaging with Burma or I guess any other regime. I mean, how much teeth do we have? We have to do a really credible assessment of that. And then what are we demanding and how high is that compared to the teeth? We have to lower our expectations or be more creative in what we're asking for, I think. In the case of Burma, not because our expectations are higher than they should be, but because if we do want to make interim progress, we've got to identify some interim steps which may be possible. So I think, you know, Gambari's agenda is the release of all political prisoners, an inclusive democratic transition process. This is a pretty high bar, and it's a bar that the regime is unlikely to. There's no teeth to enforce that. We just don't have many teeth when it comes to Burma. So I think we have to adjust our expectations and think of things which can contribute to positive change, but which may not be the headline items that we're after. We shouldn't take our eye off. It doesn't mean we shouldn't criticize or demand or insist that these things be done. It's not a lowering of our standards, but it is, in strategic terms, trying to identify the entry points that can be the most effective and that match the sticks or the leverage that we have. If we don't do that, then we just fail to make any progress at all, because we go in and we demand the big things, and the answer is no, and then we go away again. And it doesn't get us very far. Yeah.
Should we take one more?
I'll go very quickly, Maureen, and then turn it over.
Yeah, maybe
if I speak.
One and then one more. Yeah.
Two very quick. Sorry, I'm Martha Lurkey. I'm director of the scholarship programs here, and hopefully we'll have a chance to interact a little bit more while you're here. But I had a question about the cases that you got against the government officials. You said you had 10 cases. And that indicated to you that it wasn't a Machiavellian situation, but I wonder about that in terms of the regime's attitude, because couldn't this in fact be a perfect mechanism for government officials to get other people within the government they don't like out, and that would be a purely Machiavellian design and yet very believable, I think, probably in this context. And secondly, you also said that it's a government technically government-imposed forced labor, but that in the most remote areas where the government perhaps has less direct lines of authority, it's also happening, and perhaps even worse than other places. And so that leads me just to question, it gets a little bit to what you were saying before about what you offer as alternatives. Are there no alternatives? In some context, in a remote area, what are the choices if you have to get something? You can't serve both masters. Even if you make forced labor look like an unappealing alternative, then what's the third alternative? Development, no forced labor, but what do you do?
Thanks. So I should clarify on the cases. We had 10 government officials prosecuted and sent to prison, but we had many more cases that were found to be correct by the government and where administrative action was taken. So I think probably more than 60 cases. But it's not the small number that leads me to conclude that it's not Machiavellian. This is the tip of the iceberg. It's not a statistically relevant sample to judge. So we certainly don't believe that the number of cases coming through the mechanism is indicative of ups and downs in the number of cases in the country. We just don't have that statistically relevant sample. The reason I think it's not Machiavellian, or in most cases not Machiavellian, is from the investigation of the individual cases, from talking to the different people and seeing why did this happen. And it's happening mostly at a very low level. There are aspects of the problem which are very clearly coming from the top level. Through decisions to use prisoners as porters in remote areas, through decisions that the army has to live off the land, and they know that that will entail something. Whether that something is forced labor or arbitrary taxation or something else is left to the army to decide. So clearly I'm not absolving the higher level. And to say that it's not Machiavellian doesn't absolve them anyway. They have command responsibility for this. They know it's going on, and if they're not doing enough to stop it, they are responsible. So I'm not suggesting that they're not responsible, but I'm suggesting that not all the abuses arise out of are coming intentionally from the top. They're emergent in the system. I mean, I think that, for example, the Labour minister is very conscious that he may get burnt on this. If he's too cooperative with us and he allows too many cases to go through, the army is going to get very upset, or someone else is going to get very upset, or one of his colleagues is going to get very upset and point out that he's working too closely. So that was always a concern of our interlocutors. You know, they had to be constructive, or they wanted to be constructive, but there were limits. And those limits shifted, and we had to be also quite sensitive, because if it was a moment when the person's limits were reduced, would it be sensible for us to push hard and then have them removed? Or would it be sensible to just adjust? And it's a very difficult decision. And you don't always know whether they're being honest about these things. And I mean, it's very difficult. But yes, I mean, in terms of people using it to get other people out, most of the cases that we had prosecuted were very low level. I mean, these were village heads or township officials. So I don't think there's any indication that it was other township officials trying to get their colleagues out. I do think that what lay behind many of these complaints was a breakdown in trust between communities and the government, local government. So in many cases, the village committees would impose the forced labor in a way that was much more constructive with the community if they had close links to that community. In other words, look, this is something we've got to get done. It's got to be done somehow. We know it's in our interests. So look, let's see if we can work out a way where you donate as much labor as you can, and we make sure that no one kind of gets off free by making sure there's some community pressure that they participate. Actually, if they do that in the right way, it's not forced labor. It's not covered by the Forced Labor Convention. It really is community voluntary work. Unfortunately, it's a rather authoritarian, hierarchical structure and society, and things tend to be done in orders rather than in discussions. And if they would only change that, a lot of the problems would go away. So in so many of the cases that I had, it was clear that trust had broken down between the community and their leaders, and that was the root of the problem. And then the complaint came. And then, in many cases, the government would realize that they had a particularly arrogant and unhelpful local official, and they wouldn't want that either, because it creates problems unnecessarily for them. It's different if that person is imposing something that the regime is interested in. If he's cracking down on the NLD, then they maybe won't think that he's doing anything inappropriate. But if he just has an abusive relationship with his community, then that's maybe hassle that they don't need. So
Yeah, in terms of what are the alternatives, I mean, that's also something that we've been trying to elaborate, because clearly the alternatives are you don't do it, or you find resources for it somewhere else. And where do the resources come from? In fact, in many cases, these projects are not free. Using forced labor doesn't give you a free project. In many cases, the labor component of a road was siphoned off and went into people's pockets, or was used for extending the road further, and then the labor element was free. But that still incurred the same cost to the state. In many cases, the road you get is useless, because people who are being forced to do it aren't trained. They try to get off as quickly as they can to get back to their work. So when they're building up an embankment, they throw down leaves and branches and cover it with a thin layer of mud. And then, lo and behold, the road collapses. So it's actually a very inefficient way of doing development. And we tried to point out that, well, actually, you don't even need to increase the money. If you just increase the efficiency of what you're doing, the same money will produce you a lot better stuff. And by the way, we've got all these demonstration projects which we can show you. And we'll do some cash for work using sensible, well-developed engineering, and you'll see how cheap it is to actually get a road that is actually good.
Richard? Hi, I'm Madam X. I'm interested that you didn't mention, make a reference to some Burma experts who are related to me, who've actually called this a traditional, accepted traditional practice. It's interesting historically. But my question is, how big a stick could the ICC be? I mean, I'm interested, I'm glad you're here. We can talk about bringing the carrots and sticks together and try to Machiavellian ourselves, you know, with really how to move this thing. But there is a movement or movements with the ICC. I wonder if that could be used sort of in the same way. You know, if you don't do this, guess what? Even though we have no clue if that would take or not.
Yeah, in terms of the traditional aspect.
So you don't have to comment.
Yeah, okay, yeah. What we did point out is that there are lots of other poor countries who don't have any money either, and they don't use forced labor. So that's not an excuse for them. What we also pointed out is that when they ratified the convention under a democratic government in 1955, they asserted that there was no forced labor in the country and that they would not need to take advantage of the transitional provisions in the constitution to phase it out. So at least according to their labor ministry, there wasn't any forced labor in 1955. So it may have been there in history, and it was there in history. That may have been part of the reason why it reemerged, because it was somehow something that was done in the past, but it doesn't. It's not a continuous line. It's not something that's always been there. It went and came back, probably. That needs more research, and I hope to do some of that, actually. In terms of the ICC stick, I have mixed feelings about whether it's a stick, how strong a stick it is, and whether there may be other impacts which are counterproductive. Part of this is Burma-related. Part of it relates to the whole international discussion about the relationship between peace and legal implements. What I would say is while I have qualms, because I think it may in certain ways be counterproductive, I also believe very strongly that that justice can't be subjugated to peace. In other words, even if we have concerns that following legal due process may lead us in a direction which makes it more difficult to get transition, that shouldn't automatically mean we don't follow legal due process. I mean, I do strongly believe that international law has to. Now that we have the ICC, it shouldn't be a contingent thing. At the same time, I still, in individual cases, feel that applying it may be counterproductive. So very, very hard. And also, we don't actually have an ICC option. And so the question is how to make it a credible option. Credible enough in the eyes of the regime that they will believe that it's real, and they won't just have their legal experts say, forget it, it's a hot air balloon. So that's two questions. I mean, one, can we do it? And second, if we do it, is it helpful?
Thank you very much, Richard, for a very stimulating and provocative conversation, one that will continue throughout the month of May during your stay here at OSI, and then again in November when you're coming back.
October
you're coming back to OSI. So anybody who is interested in interacting with Richard during this in the next couple of weeks, you can approach him directly upstairs or come through any of us in the Open Society Fellowship Program, and we'd be delighted to set something up. But let's give Richard a round of applause for a very good talk.